What were the moments in your life when you were faced with fear and either you succumbed to it or you overcame it?
I believe every time I sat down to write my book, you know, the little devil in my head would say, you can't do this. Who do you think you are going to write a book? You need to be working. You need to be doing something else. Instead of giving myself permission, I fought myself every day to sit down. And the fear of it, I'd be a failure.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, speaking with Susan Purvis about her nonfiction book, Go Find, My Journey to Find the Lost and Myself. It's a compelling story about training a search and rescue avalanche dog. Don't go away.
When did you know you had a book in you?
Probably in the third grade.
Yeah.
I always knew I wanted to write a book, but I just had to go live the right story to tell. And when I was working my dog, I was always getting interviewed, and I always wanted to be a writer, but I felt like I never had the writing chops, or how can I make a living? So I had to go do other things. And then one day I said, you know, I have enough money, I have enough time and space in my life where if I don't do this now, life will pass me by. And by golly, if I can train a dog to find a person, I can write a book about training a dog to find a person.
What's the analogy here between training a dog and writing a book?
Yeah, I had to recount all of my training when I was writing my book. And then when I was writing my book, I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the training phase of learning how to write a book. And I had to go surround myself with mentors, join a group, you know, hang out with writers, read a lot, write a lot. And then I realized once I sold my manuscript, it was like getting certified with my dog, Tasha. And then when my book came out, you know, now the missions are starting to happen, but not very many people know. So now I have to go sell myself, just like I had to with my search and rescue dog. So we don't know what's going to happen next.
Right. I was hoping that you would just tell us the story of Tasha.
Oh, Tasha. Here's a fun story. I was back in Crested Butte, Colorado, the last great Colorado ski town of about 1,000 people on book tour. I packed the place. And my neighbors were there, so a lot of my old friends and neighbors came out, and my neighbor stands up for the question and answer, and he's like, you know, Sue, I got to tell everybody a story. So my dog had a eating obsession. I had a little black lab, and they are just like little piglets. They run around, and they just want to eat, and she would eat anything. Mm-hmm. So I would let her out because I'd get lazy. I wasn't supposed to let my dog out because a free roaming dog is bad Sue, mm-hmm. But it was like -5. And then I realized, oh God, she took off again, bad dog owner. And then I would look across the street at the Hoag's house and I would notice, aha, I'd see the door was open. Uh-huh. So my dog was able to open their door, front door, which is this big wooden door. She'd figure out how to open that door. She'd help herself into the house. She'd march upstairs. She knew how to open up their pantry door in their kitchen. And usually 10 minutes later, by the time I followed her in there, she was head down in a 40-pound bag of dog food.
Wow.
And I would have to pull her off that bag by her hips. Uh-huh. And she'd come up coughing and gagging and snorting and choking, trying to get the last little bits of kibble down.
Part of Tasha's charm is she has mischief in her, especially around, as you said, around food. How did you know she could become a search and rescue, an avalanche dog, and cadaver dog?
You know what? She didn't have a choice because I was shoving it down her throat because yeah. I had an agenda. And in general, you know, dogs, they're meant to find things, right? Mm-hmm. And so She was so good at finding food, and she was so good at finding human feces, mm-hmm. that if she can find food and feces, she can find a human buried in the snow, drowned in the water, hidden in a tree.
One of the things I loved about reading the book was learning some of the facts that humans shed dead skin cells mixed with bacteria called rafts, and most of us lose 50 million rafts per second, a third of which land on the ground and two-thirds that sort of drift off into the air. And so dogs are either trained to be trailing dogs, which means nose to the ground, or air scent dogs. Can you just walk us through the basics of the training process? How do you even start to train a search and rescue dog?
Yeah, it's so fascinating. You know, the dogs are telling us stuff all day long, every day, but as humans, we ignore them because we don't speak their language.
Right.
So we start out, I have to create a bond with my dog. So I'm with my dog 24/7. And then what happens then is I met Poodle Lady. She lived in Aspen, and she had a standard white poodle as her search dog. But she taught me how to play the hide-and-seek game. So she would hold Tasha, and then I would act like a silly little girl and scream and yell, and I'd have Tasha's favorite toy or piece of food, and I'd be like, la, 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 come and get me, and I'd run away in plain sight and hit the ground so she could see me. Maybe I'd run 50 feet and just drop to the ground. And then Carla was back there, a poodle lady, would be like, Tasha, getting her all fired up. And, you know, Tasha's lips would curl, and she'd have her paws up like she's a little racehorse. And
right.
She'd say, go find. Let her go. And then Tasha would just scamper down the trail, these paws the size of quarters in the dirt, and then just pounce on my head and start tugging at my hair. And that's how you start out. So we started out really small, like, you know, 50
right.
feet. She could see me. And then you slowly increase the distance and the difficulty, and then eventually you kind of blindfold them. So by the seventh exercise, Tasha couldn't see where I went. And we would do the same thing. So I'd run 50 feet and then take a hard right and hide behind a bush. And the first time we did that, Carla said, Tasha, go find. She lets her go. And I realized Tasha was using her eyes and not her nose. And she ran right past me and fell over into a riverbank.
Right.
And that's when you go, all right, so you have to go slow. You can't be too aggressive and too fast-paced with these little critters. And eventually the dog learns at the same time as the human, oh, I have to use my nose.
Yes.
Pretty exciting.
What's a refind?
Oh, yeah, the refind. It is the most important skill you have to teach a search and rescue dog to do. And I didn't really know anything about it until she was over a year and a half old. So dogs can find things. Okay, they can find the hot dog in the woods and they'll eat it. Well, if it's a human out there, they can just go to the human, but you know, I'm the other half of the equation. So the dog's got to be able to communicate to me that they found something. So we call that a refind. Some dogs naturally have refinds, like border collies. They go back and forth, check on you. My dog didn't really care about me. She would find her target, but then I had to train her to come back and tell me. And humans are pretty stupid, so whatever they do, you can't miss it. So some dogs will come back and jump right on your chest. That would be ideal because you cannot miss that.
Right.
Some dogs will just maybe come back and touch your toes and then take off. Some dogs might come back and bark at you. So I had to train my dog to do a refind. And I wanted her to come back and jump on me and say, you stupid human, follow me. And then they whip around and go back to the target. And so they close in on the distance. So you follow them. But my dog had her own agenda. She wasn't much of a retriever. She didn't really do a solid refine. So half of my battle was to just understand her behavior. And she was a little overweight all the time because she always ate too much. So some days when she got too hot, she'd just stand there and look at me from a quarter mile away and go like, I'm done.
You made those moments of training really fun and exciting. And I was hoping that you would read a scene in which your husband, Doug, and you are working with Tasha.
Okay. Tasha jerks on the leash, pulling me down the sagebrush-lined trail to find Doug, who hid 30 minutes ago. August thunderheads build, roiling over mountains, Winds swirl upslope, gusting the clouds into different shapes every few minutes. Cloud shadows dance across the steep, rocky hills, broken with intermittent dry creek beds, while I run behind Tasha as we test her refind in the field. Halfway down the trail, I release her leash. I must trust that she will find Doug and come back and tell me by jumping on me. She weaves in and out of the trail, snorting as she goes, enjoying the freedom from the leash. Her bell tinkles. Crisscrossing the trail, she looks back at me. I can't tell what her eyes are telling me. I stop, and she spins away from me and moves in Doug's direction. Good girl! Stay close! 5 minutes later, after tracking Doug's scent, she returns to me. Her behavior tells me that she hasn't found him, as her gait is fast, her tail stands erect, and her nose is to the ground. I reinforce her job. Go find! Tasha's ears perk up. She spins away from me and runs away. Far in the distance, small green flags flap in the wind, a sign of Doug's route. Good girl, Tasha! She disappears into the quaking aspen forest. Wind drowns out the sound of her bell. I whistle for her. Minutes elapse before Doug's voice whispers over the radio. Sue, I'm hiding in a tree. She just circled it 3 times. Then she looked up and found me. Tasha's using her hearing and her eyes to find me. But she's so tired and hot, and I think she forgot to return to you. Tell her to find Sue, I call back on the radio. Throwing my voice into the air, I call Tasha's name to assist her, followed by 3 blasts on the whistle, meaning come. Her bell jingles. She appears with foam oozing out of her mouth. When she spots me, she stops, her eye contact unwavering. Even though she stands 20 yards away and doesn't jump on me, I wonder if this is her refind. Show me! Did you find Doug? I run to her, offering her water. She whips her head around for me to follow. I mentally file away her refind action, stopping and staring, rather than jumping on me. That's her way, not mine. During the quiet mile-long walk back to the truck, no words are exchanged. It hits me. Tasha's training me. I'm the trainee. She's the trainer. I can only wonder whether dog and English really jibe.
What changed for you once you realized that Tasha was training you?
I think it's probably called humbleness. I think I go through life now. Sometimes we think we're experts at something, but every day we need to be learning and be open to learning. And so that was a really big gift she gave me. Because in our human ways, we try to shove our agenda down everybody and everything. And if we could just be quiet, sit and listen, and we might actually learn a lot faster. What I had learned then in all of this is I would take one step forward. And because I was training on my own, for the most part, I had to take 7 steps backwards. Normally, if I was training with a group of dog handler teams in, say, an urban area, I might have gotten through the process a lot faster. Mm-hmm. But, we did it our way, and there's some beauty to that, and it makes for a really fun book because half of my book is about all of our failures.
I was going to say, Sue, reading your book felt like a balloon that would get inflated and then popped over and over again.
Yeah.
And you write so viscerally about those moments of failure or humiliation. There was one line that struck me. You wrote, I sit frozen in my own trauma, drooping in disappointment at myself. How did you pull yourself together after all of those?
I just had a goal. When I got that little puppy, and the reason why I got the puppy is I needed purpose and passion, but I learned that when I was in ski patrol school, that across the street from this world-class ski resort, 3 toddlers were buried by an avalanche at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning while they were waiting for a shuttle bus to bring them back to Houston, Texas. And the patrol team was telling me this story, and it happened 6 years earlier. And I said, well, what did your dog do? They had an avalanche dog at the time. And they said, well, the dog couldn't find the kids. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Isn't that the dog's only job? And the answer they gave me wasn't good enough. And it was in that moment I thought, I wonder if I could train a dog to save a life, vowing to never leave anyone behind. And so I was going to train so much that I knew when after we got certified and we got called for a mission, we would never leave anyone behind.
Has that been the case?
Yeah. We achieved that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Susan Purvis about Go Find, My Journey to Find the Lost and Myself. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
One of the points that gets hammered over and over again is the egos in the field of search and rescue, which maybe shouldn't have surprised me, but it did. What can you speak to about ski patrol and search and rescue and, you know, who's got a hero complex, as you write?
And even myself, probably. I'm still in the business. You know, I'm an avalanche educator. I work around men. I was a geologist. And I think egos are everywhere. It's even in the medical business. And then you have professionals and you have volunteers and everybody wants to be the hero, especially when you show up at missions. So it's a really interesting dance. How we play in the sandbox is a really interesting task. My parents didn't teach me how to play in the sandbox. Until we get into our 30s, we don't really have to play in the sandbox. So I had a lot of hard lessons to learn. And, you know, even today in Montana where I live, the egos are just rampant where I live. I can't even be on search and rescue there.
Yeah.
Because it's too much. And there's infrequency of missions. And so when there's a mission, everybody's all ramped up and they're all stepping on each other.
I know at one point you mentioned that you're one of seven women on a 50-person ski patrol crew. So can you just talk a little bit about what it's like to be a female doing what you do?
Yeah, interestingly enough, when I went back to Crested Butte, I still don't think there's hardly, you know, more than a couple of women on their search and rescue team and probably not a whole lot more on ski patrol. And I've always worked in men's fields. Even as I get older, I'm in my 50s now, I always have to reprove myself to the men I'm working with. And I'm like, wow, do the men have to do that? No, if they get shifted from one ski resort to another or one town to another, there's probably not a whole lot of proving going on. And so I think that's why I like being a writer now. I can just sit home and nobody bugs me.
So in terms of you being a geologist, one of the things I kept having to remind myself as we're in these ski towns and, you know, we're buried in snow is that half of your life was spent in the Dominican Republic looking for gold.
Yeah.
So can you just integrate these two places and also help us understand why Tasha became such an important, you know, purpose and passion?
Yeah, so I got my start in geology here at the University of Montana. I got a degree here. It's really fun to be back. And actually, right out of college, I was busy doing gold exploration in Montana. And that's where I met Doug at the time. And
Doug's your husband.
My husband in the book.
Right.
And he became an expert in Caribbean geology. And he was asked to run a gold exploration project in the Dominican Republic. And the nice thing about that is we could live anywhere we wanted to. So we chose the last great Colorado ski town because, Montana was just a little too far from the Caribbean. And so I always had one foot in the mud and one foot in the snow. Our house in Crested Butte, Colorado, was at 9,500 feet. That's like the highest peaks in Montana.
Right.
And then we'd commute to sea level. And our commute was 2,000 miles. And I was really lonely down there because Doug was oftentimes in the city doing business deals, and I was out in El Campo with the peasant farmers. And we were on this really dangerous drug route between Haiti and Puerto Rico. And I thought, what on earth am I doing out here? Like, life is passing me by. I'm not having fun. I'm not skiing. I'm down here slaving away without any power. I was scared all the time. And so one day I said, I'm going to go get on ski patrol. And I grew up ski racing, so I had a strong ski background. And I was able to get on ski patrol. And that's when I learned about the avalanche accident. And then soon after, I said, all right, I'm getting a dog. Now, that's pretty irresponsible because I had a job in the Dominican Republic and now I have a puppy. And there probably wasn't a lot of communication looking back with my husband. I just sort of did it.
The threat of rebelliousness comes through. How are you and Tasha alike?
Yeah, right. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And you know what? My mom's like, I think I get it from my mom. So I'm going to blame all this on my mom. My mom's still alive. And what's interesting is what I learned is the dog handlers in urban environments near Denver or Fort Collins, they have to keep their dogs on lead because the dogs will get killed if they run around. I lived in a mountain town. And I could let my dog loose. And I always believed, well, if my dog loved me, she'd come back. But, you know, my dog had a different agenda. She's like, yeah, I'm free. I'll be back in like 17 hours. Oh, you didn't hear me? And it's kind of like that, you know, I don't want to have to work in an office building. That's that same being caged, right? I didn't want to be caged in my life. I didn't want my dog to be caged. And we learn when we're free thinking. Animals. And we learn to make really good decisions based on our mistakes. So even though I got hounded for trying, you know, my husband would yell at me, keep that dog on lead, you know, I'd let her free because I wanted her to grow and develop and to make good decisions. As a result, she was a darn good search dog. I mean, she found everything she went to look for.
In terms of your own sense of being lost, towards the end of the book, you write, I'm not lost. I'm not unloved. I'm not unhappy. The bottom line, though, is that I'm not aware of how lost I actually am. How did you get lost in your own life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like now that I've written the book and the book has been out for a while, I'm like the lost expert. So I say in my book that I could understand where any lost person would go and Tasha would find him. Yet in my own personal life, I got lost. I got off path. What I had to do in my discovery and in my book is I could have written a book just about our missions. Mm-hmm. But 3 years into writing my book, I wrote the end of my last chapter, which was all of a sudden I get caught in an avalanche. Not a physical avalanche, but an emotional avalanche. And I thought, but I'm the expert. How does the expert get caught? Then I had to go back and read. The one book that really influenced me was by Lawrence Gonzalez called Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. And he talks about the five phases of being lost, or Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talks about the five stages of grieving. It's all the same stuff. And I realized the first phase is denial. Mm-hmm. And I had been in denial about my personal relationship with my husband for a very long time. I didn't have the tools to fix the problem. So we tend to ignore it, or we bury it, or we put it under the rug. And then eventually, if you don't pay attention, things are going to fall apart. Mm-hmm. So I look at people now. They start talking to me and telling me their story or their misery, and I go, you're in such denial. So we can be in denial about our health, our relationships with people, the relationships with ourselves, our business, our finances, or you can get lost in the woods. Mm-hmm. It all kind of looks the same.
So if I'm thinking that you finding yourself also has to do with maybe coming back to third grade, Sue, and saying, all right, write the book, does that resonate? Because you've lived a very full life. And to publish a book in your 50s, that's pretty rad.
Yeah. And a memoir with no training.
Right.
And no skill. Like, I would be the worst English student in high school. Like, I barely passed English or creative writing. So my message to everybody is, if you have passion about something, then it gives you purpose. And really, all I could do is not quit, because if I would have stopped writing, nobody would have known anything about this story. So what does it do for me? It gives me, you know, a speaking platform. I can help others, which, you know, all along I've always been helping people. And now I can help them instead of finding them in the woods. I can help them find themselves over the telephone or over coffee.
can you mentioned before the interview that you've been doing some funny appearances. What's been some of your more fun appearances since having this book out?
Oh, let's see. Well, last night I did a podcast, and the first 5 minutes we talked about, well, what are you drinking while we're speaking? You know, so we got to talk about our adult beverage in detail. And then the interviewers talked about his adult beverage, you know, and how he, you know, mixes all these great things together. And I thought, how fun. We get to talk about something else. What I find in the speaking tour with my book is a lot of people want to talk about the writing process. Mm-hmm. So many people. The people in the audience, all, you can just tell, you know, it's in their eyes that they go, I want to write a book. Mm-hmm. But their fear is stopping them. We know that. It's, you know, it's overwhelming. It's like training a dog. It takes about 6 years to find fluency and then a few years of revision.
Susan Purvis is a lead instructor with Wilderness Medical Associates and the American Institute for Avalanche Research and Education. She lives in northwest Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.